Our guest speaker this evening is Dr. Scott Taylor from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm going to very, very superficially tell you a little bit about Scott. Then went on and earned a doctorate in educational leadership from the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, and currently serves as a faculty member at South Central College in Minnesota. He says that he leads a double life. During the day, connected with his professional career, he is a mentor and educator for small business owners. At night, he transforms into an intrepid, near-death experience researcher, writer, and speaker. He has personally had an empathic near-death experience. In his research, he has interviewed hundreds of near-death experiencers. He serves on the board of IANS and is a regular presenter at conferences, workshops, and houses of worship. I wanted to just mention one thing that he does as a hobby his wife told me about. She told me that Scott has an interesting hobby, and she says he's very, very good at this. He's passionate about the sport of curling. It sounds really interesting, so maybe I'll take just a minute to tell you what this is. I hope I do a good job here. The way it was described to me, it's kind of like a combination hybrid of bowling, shuffleboard, horseshoes, kind of combined in an odd way. First of all, it's played on ice, okay? So it's a cold weather sport. And it involves a large granite block that has a flat surface on the bottom and a handle on top, and you slide this rock, and using the handle, you can turn it as you slide it, kind of like a bowling ball when you're bowling. And you try to get this thing to slide across the ice and stop as close as possible to the center of several concentric rings that are on the ice, and you're scored on how close you get to the center. Other players can slide their rocks down and knock you out. It sounds like a really intriguing game. I'd love to see it sometime, maybe participate in the game. I was going to introduce the title of the talk in just a minute, but you can probably see it's up here on the screen in front of you. And since it's there, I'll skip that note, but I want to make just a personal note. The topic tonight is, for me personally, a very important topic. It's something that I wanted to find a guest speaker to talk about for a very long time. I won't go into why it's personal for me, but I have personal reasons for being interested in it. And I wanted to just make this personal statement before I turn this over to Dr. Taylor. About every generation in America, we seem to go through this trauma and repeat this trauma over and over again. It seems like there's this continual conflict between religion and science. I experienced some of this personally when I was a youth in North Carolina, where I grew up, and it was painful for me. When I see it happening again in this generation, it's always painful for me to watch. I never felt personally any conflict between religion and science. I've always been interested in science personally, and I think science is an exciting field, a wonderful field, and there's just so many neat things that it goes into. I wanted to just read this very short thing to you and ask you to think about this. I have no idea whether this will tie into the talk tonight, because I have not heard the talk myself. I will be hearing this for the first time along with you. But regardless of whether this ties into his talk, I'd like you to think about it on your own anyway. Among the world's most respected religious leaders, one of them gave a definition of religion. The definition comes from the Dalai Lama, who visited Salt Lake not too long ago. This is what he said religion is. Quote, "The whole purpose of religion is to facilitate love and compassion, patience, tolerance, humility, and forgiveness," end quote. Nothing in this definition conflicts in any way with the purpose of science, which is to explore the structures, mechanisms, and processes of nature. There is no conflict. That conflict is man-made, and it's false. And I just wanted to say that to you once you think about it. I am excited to give you our guest speaker tonight, Dr. Scott Taylor. And I am going to learn a lot from this. I feel it. And I hope we all do.
Am I loud enough in the back there? In the cheap seats? Is... Thanks. Nice to see you all tonight, and really nice to be here in Salt Lake City. I have to tell you that I love the way the world works, this whole coincidence thing. You met my wife, Ann Hunter, and we are celebrating our 5th wedding anniversary. Yay. And we have a tradition that we try to maintain on our wedding anniversary, and that is we take a trip to a city we've never been to before. And so I was this close to booking an Amtrak trip from Minneapolis to Milwaukee, where we were going to spend the time there visiting. I've been there. They have a fabulous art museum. It's all modern and really large, and we were like this close. And then Eldon calls. And Eldon says, "Don't you want to come to Salt Lake City and talk to the IANS group?" And I looked at Ann and said, "Have you ever been to Salt Lake City?" "I've never been to Salt Lake City." "So, we're spending our wedding anniversary with you." So, I have to begin this evening with a confession, and that is that I am a near-death researcher. That's my primary focus. I am not a physicist, but I am a person. My particular slice of life in researching near-death experiences about cosmology, that how is the universe put together, and what do near-death experiencers say to us about what the world is like, how it's put together, how it works, and then try to put that in some sort of a coherent fashion, and then compare it to what the latest research is that scientists are telling us about. Okay, so I'm going to do 3 things tonight. First off, I'm going to talk about where I get my research from, because one of the questions you should be thinking in your head is, who is Scott Taylor and where is this information coming from? The second thing is I want to talk to you about what near-death experiencers say about cosmology. What happens when they had their near-death experience such that they found out about how the universe is put together? It's kind of a small group that actually explored that during their near-death experience. And then the third thing, and the vast majority of my talk, I'm going to be addressing physics and what the latest research has been showing us about how the universe is put together from a scientific perspective. There has been a ton of research that has been done just within the last 3, 4, 5 years. So a lot of this is really new stuff, and I hope you enjoy it. One of the things, and this is another confession here, is that I usually don't try to do a PowerPoint presentation at night because, well, let's face it, you've all had a long day, the lights are dim, and you're going to get, like, sleepy on me. However, the physics section is such that those of you, you know, that are kind of up this bent, this is a huge topic. It's really complex, and it's a little weird. So I had to do a PowerPoint just to keep myself on track so that it's nice and logical, and when we get through it, I hope you'll come to the same spot that I did. Part 1, research. 2 years ago, I gave the keynote address at the 30th anniversary of the founding of IANS. The first presentation was a history of what we know about near-death, and it was my job to summarize the research for that. I gave you the benefit of that in a lot less time. But in that process, I reviewed 41 scientific studies. I read peer-reviewed journals for the last 30 years. Reviewed 33 studies in the U.S. and 6 in Western countries. A small number of books, 1 dissertation. And the whole of it is that I summarized what has happened to over 3,000 NDE people. And in the interest of full disclosure, like, Eldon said, I am a near-death experiencer, having had an empathetic or shared near-death experience. In addition, when I did my dissertation, I put these up so you could like chuckle. So my doctorate was in educational leadership, but my dissertation was about near-death experiencers, and I've interviewed at least a couple hundred people formally and a lot more informally, and frankly, this was probably one of my most challenging cases. In the physics arena, there are relatively few books that come out that do a good job summarizing what's going on. These two books are relatively recent, in 2007. Much of the information that I'm going to be relating to comes out of there. The Intention Experiment, this one's really interesting. It's got a good chapter on the scientific research, a little wonkish, and this one has the same sort of thing. The beginning is a summary of the research, and this one is does a really nice job of explaining things in layman's language. That was part one. So now we're talking about part two. And because I'm an academic, all academics start with a definition, don't you know? Jan Holden was president of IANS. In her research, this is the definition that her group came up with. Reported memories of profound psychological events with certain common paranormal, transcendental, and mystical features that occurred during a special state of consciousness associated with an episode of actual or threatened physical, psychological, emotional, or spiritual death, and that were followed by certain common after effects. Jan was also the one that recruited me onto the national board, for which I just finished my term in December. There are lots of ways to slice near-death experiencers. As you know, in 1975, Raymond Moody came out and wrote a book, Life After Life. And that book was filled with anecdotal stories about what he had encountered as a psychologist and as a medical student. And essentially what he did is he planted a flag in the ground and he said, yo-ho, there's something really interesting happening here. Would somebody please come along and research it for me? And sure enough, Kenneth Ring from the University of Connecticut, Michael Sabom, who's an MD, Bruce Grayson with the University of Virginia, they all took the challenge and said, yes, we will come and we will apply the rigors of scientific research to the near-death experience. Ken Ring and Bruce Grayson approached it from, well, let's see what's here. Actually, Michael Sabom did it from an anti-standpoint. He read Raymond Moody's book and said, I don't think so. This sounds like a wacko. And sure enough, when he did the research, he went, there's really something here. So what happens is each one of them described the near-death. This is early, right? So this is really early in the research. And they describe near-death experiences in different ways. Raymond Moody with calling it 11 elements. And Ken Ring, 5 stages. Michael Sabom, 3 types. Bruce Grayson said there's 4 components. So with each one of them, they slice the near-death experience in different ways, and which is nice because you get different nuances with different lenses. So what we're going to do tonight, whoops, I forgot, we have to have a caution here. Right from the get-go, Raymond Moody and everybody who's done research, including myself, has this caution. No one experiences all the elements of an NDE. No two are identical. The sequence is not universal. Each case is unique. But son of a gun, when you put 3,000 cases together, you get some really strong tendencies. So if I'm talking tonight like this is the way it is, well, that's a really strong tendency. But note that, of course, there are exceptions. What I'm going to do is I'm going to use Ring's model because it nicely incorporates everybody else. And just as a quick review, in his, he said there were 5 stages, and a certain percentage of people experience each one of the stages. At first is the sense of peace and well-being, 60% have that experience. Body separation, out-of-body experiences, and being able to move around and see your physical environment apart from your physical body, 37%. Entering the darkness of the void is 23, see the light 16, enter the light, actually 10% of the folks experience that. And what we're going to do tonight is we're going to just take that middle slice, the entering the darkness part, because that's where the folks who are interested in or were shown about how the world works, that's the stage they were in when this information came to them. So this is going to be our slice tonight, is just that middle one, because that seems to be where the keys to cosmology are located. Now this person is experiencing the void, right? Stage three, entering the darkness. He's in this stage. It's nice, it's black, it's velvety. So stage three is all about this entering a realm that really is without form. It's black, it may have some purple undertones. It is a place of no dimension, meaning no time, no space, but it is, they talk about the void as being like without things to see, but no time, no space, but it is alive. You get the sense of that? It's alive, but it's black. Until, of course, there's this little bitty light up in the corner that turns into a tunnel, and then you move through the tunnel to go to the light. And hopefully it's not, you know, an orderly with a near-death kit. So stages one and two have to do with the physical universe. I mean, the sense of peace, they're still around in their physical setting where their body is. The outer body kinds of things tend to happen around the physical body. When we talk about the realm of the physical universe that we are in right now, that's called the dualistic universe. And the dualistic universe is a universe where I'm separate from Dave, and I'm separate from Ann and Susan, totally even the Mike. The words that are often used to describe the physical universe, the universe that we're in right now, is either or. Either Dave or me, or Ann or Susan. So there's this dualistic thing that says, I am separate than every place else. In stage three, we leave the physical universe and we enter the non-physical universe. And in stage three, this transition takes us to a universe that is outside of time and space. It takes us into the void. And in here, everything is connected. All parts of reality are part of everything else. And the words that are used to describe this arena are both and. Dave and I both have our separate consciousness, and we're part of something larger. So we're all hooked together, but yet we still have a separateness. So it's both of these things. I am an individual, and I am part of a collective whole. How do I know this? Well, when I ask the people that I interview to describe what is the unity universe, these are the kind of quotes that come out. Now, all of these people I have interviewed personally, so I know that their quotes are in context. Sometimes when you read books, you're never quite sure if the quotes, you know, really match what you want to talk about. I know these folks. I mean, I talked to them, and when I asked them about what the unity universe was all about, they said, you know, it's all wrapped up in one. It's connected, whole, oneness, everywhere, all places, pervasive. Martha, everything, everyone is part of everything else. It looks like they're all trying to get to the same place, which is we have a unity universe that is, you've heard of the expression, the web of experience, the web of life. This is where they're talking about, where everything seems to be connected to everything else. We also know that the unity universe is different than the physical universe because people have different abilities. Because when you talk about, well, what did you do up there? Well, they talk about things well. I mean, we have consciousness outside of our physical body. And then they talk about physical senses. Well, we don't have five physical senses up there. We may have six or seven or eight. The most common one that I hear beyond our physical five are like they're able to perceive energies and understand what those energies are about. We don't talk, at least with our mouths or our physicalness. We exchange information through telepathy or shared mental experiences. We don't have stereoscopic vision. You know, this whole thing of like doing this, don't need it. You can see 360 degrees. You can look anywhere you want. Telescopic vision is really cool if you're in Salt Lake City, because you can go, hey, you know how many mountains are in Minnesota? Except, I did a little digression, I'm sorry, but do you remember the TV show Little House on the Prairie?
Yeah.
Right? Michael Landon in the beginning. At the beginning, he showed, you know, they're out in Walnut Grove, and he's plowing, got the horses, and in the background is what? It's a mountain. In the back, do you know how far away the mountains are from Minnesota? 2,000 miles. So it would be really helpful. Like in Salt Lake City, we're here, we get to see the mountains. And you say, what's on the top of that mountain? Well, if you're in the Unity Universe, you just have telescopic vision. You can just like drill right up to it and see what's going on up there. Or if that doesn't suit you, I want to be there. You're there. Movement at the speed of thought. All you have to do is think it, and it's done. Body adapts. This is kind of cool, actually. When you're in the Unity Universe, maybe you got a body that looks like this. Or not. Maybe it looks like Casper the Friendly Ghost. Kind of this amorphous thing. Or maybe it looks like a cloud. Or maybe it's just a point of consciousness. No body at all. There's no time. Or all time. I want to go investigate George Washington at the, you know, what was it like? What was he feeling when he crossed the Delaware? Okay, let's go there. Drill down is kind of a unique thing. Those of you who are familiar with accounting packages, you know, you can take and computers, you know, there's transactions and you're sitting there going, well, what's this check about? And you can double click on it and it opens up the check and then you say, well, what did we do that for? And you double click and the information comes out. So you can drill down the same way in the Unity Universe. So you're having a conversation with somebody and they're kind of out of sorts and you're going, why are they feeling that way? And you're shown why they've got that particular attitude. And then you say, well, where did that come from? From the mother. And then why does the mother feel like that? You can drill down into the mother's childhood. And you can drill down into the grandma's childhood to find out what the origin is of this really nasty event that's happening to you right now.
Spiritual hyperlinking.
Right, spiritual hyperlinking. Tacky for you, nice job. Okay, and then we've got this thing about all-knowing. All information is available all the time. So if you want to know about something, you just put it, and it's answered. You don't even get the question, the answer's there. All information, linked to everything. What do you want to know? Everything is there. And the last thing is, in all the interviews I've done, I never once, not once, had anybody say to me, whoa, that was so cool, Scott. I got to like see at the top of the mountain. I didn't have to go anywhere. I never did that. It was perfectly natural. They described this like, well, of course, I have 360-degree vision, and I can float outside my body and look at my bald spot. Perfectly natural. So what you get from that as an interviewer is the sense that we've come home, that this is our natural birthright, that we know how to operate in this realm already. There's nothing we have to learn. We can just do this stuff. So what I want to do now is just take a couple of those and give you some quotes from people so you get more of a sense of the qualities of the Unity Universe. One of which I told you was the timeless nature. You know, Martha says, how can something not be done in time? It was done between time. You're on their time, and their time is totally different. And I like Polly's. There's no sense of future now or then. It was just this sort of is. Was all present. A place there wasn't a sense of time dimension. In other words, if you're in a place where there's no time, you don't sense that you're without it. Does that make sense? It just is. This is one of the beauties I find about the Hebrew Bible. For those of you that like, you know, the Old Testament. The description, what's the name of God? I am. I am. There's no sense of time about that. I am. That's the space that this comes from. Scott Taylor interpretation. Energetic. I ask them, what is the Unity Universe? Or more specifically, what is the void about? And they said, The void is wavelength. Now, isn't that a weird description? The void is movement. Now, remember, this is a black space with nothing in it. Right? There's no sight. There's no nothing. It hums. It's just energy. And what I like about Holly's description, follow along with me, it's more than energy. It's how the energy moves between all things and all beings, between every atom and neutron and proton and electron. It is a pervasive energy, and energy is an inadequate word. What I want you to notice about this is that Holly is saying it's not the energy of the electron and proton. There's something in between the electron and proton that is providing the energy of the universe, and that matter comes from this energetic field.
Who's Holly?
She's got good billings on this one. Yeah. Well, you know, that's a really good point. You know, you interview a lot of near-death experiencers. Some of them spend a lot of time in one of the stages and not others. And Holly, in particular, spent a lot of time in stage three and asked questions about, she wanted to know how the universe was put together. So she was very rich for me. Some people, not so much. You know, they'll touch on it. Or Holly also had, my memory was right, I think she had her master's degree in journalism or something. So she had a vocabulary. Some people who I interview have zero scientific background. And they've got, it's a real struggle for them to come up with the words, the concepts, to try to describe their experience. Because remember, in stage three, a lot of this happens without words. This is a telepathic knowledge that they're getting from either the universal knowledge or some being that is telling them something. But it's, you know, get it as a gestalt kind of thing. It's a knowingness. And in particular, I wanted to know about the void. And Martha told me that you can have a void, but there's still something in it. Another person called the void the place of unmanifested potential. Or another person called it place of infinite potentiality, in that what happens, what they say what happens is that this area of blackness is seething with potential. There's nothing there, but what happens is all you have to do is imagine something, and it's like your consciousness creates a template that goes against the void, and the void organizes matter or an experience to come back to you so that you get what you want. I want to go to the top of the mountain. How many of you done this where you go? I really want to talk to my sister. Ring, ring. You just did it. Put a consciousness, a request out into the void, and it came back to you in a way that you wanted it to happen. Somebody in the back there is like going, Taylor.
It's kind of like it allows freedom of the individual to express themselves, whatever they perceive anything as. It gives them the potential because it's unlimited. Whatever you print on it is yours.
How many of you are fans of Star Trek? Oh, yeah, okay. So you get this one. The Replicator. Remember the Replicator? Catherine Janeway, Starship Voyager. She would always go up to the Replicator and say, what? Oh, come on. Earl Grey, hot. Was that John Luke?
Yes.
Earl Grey, hot. Earl Grey, hot. Okay. My mistake. The metaphor is still good, however, which is Captain Picard had a request. He said it, and he got it back. That's how the void works. It's a place of unmanifested potential. It's the replicator. It says, what do you want? And I'll give it to you. All you have to do is formulate the mental template, and the void will fill it in for you. That's how they perceive the void.
Daughter and I were on the airplane, and we read a wonderful article in Scientific Mechanics. They actually, this last month, took a picture of the void and found out that there is energy between the atoms, and it has constraints. They actually have a picture now of that energy Yeah, they sprayed the 60 supernovas.
Cool.
Cool.
Cool. I'm coming to that.
Well, I thought that was very powerful. They actually now finally been able to take care of it.
They took a picture of what I got. Who, it's like Scientific American or one of those?
No, it was Scientific Mechanics.
The article is called Dark Energy.
Oh, okay. Great. Jeez. I love it when you guys are ahead of me. There is this holographic nature to the unity universe, which says, like Dolly, instead of traveling to go see a mountain or seeing the sky, you're in it. You don't have to go there. You are part of the mountain. You are part of the sky. And then later, she says that we are within the experience of the universe. We are not a part of the universe, that we are looking at it and having this experience different. That's a dualistic perspective. In the unity perspective, it's saying that we are part of the experience. We are part of the unity.
If you read the Vedas or Muktananda or Maharshi or any of those teachers, they point us towards trying to connect with who we really are. And when you describe the void, that is exactly what they describe as who we really are, not something separate from us.
I just wanted to mention, because there's a lot of spiritual teachings here too, that make sense. But I read Tesla, the autobiography by, I can't remember her name, but the person is Margaret Cheney. If you read that, it has some interesting things that Tesla did in order to create his inventions. He actually used what he referred to as ether. He would create something in his mind, or in ether, he thought. He would run it until it broke, and then he would make another one. And that's part of the way he designed his inventions.
You guys are good. I'm going to come up with ether, too. This is great. This is fun, talking to people like this. Okay. All-knowing nature of the universe. Remember that section in there? And Abraham said, whatever we were thinking, we all thought that together. The answer was there before you finished asking the question. And Margaret saying, it's a different kind of knowledge. There are no words. It's just knowledge. You just know. We knew what other people knew. So this area, this unity universe, this area of the void, has this component to it where you just know. In terms of what the near-death experiencers have told us, they told us that our universe is a unity universe. It's energetic. It's reactive. What we put out is what we get back. And that consciousness is the template or the organizing principle of the universe. This is what the near-death experiencers have told me. Golden rule. If you go on the web and you type in golden rule, you come up with all kinds of websites. I was on one that had, you know, every major religion has some version of this. It can be worded differently, but it's some version of do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The one I looked at, there were 26 from the different major world religions. I want you to think of this as people from 4,000 years ago or before trying to explain not only a moral prescription, a moral imperative, you know, treat people well, but how the unity universe works. It works like this. Do unto others. In other words, the universe is reactive. What you put out is what you get back. And when people who've had this experience, near-death experiences, come back, and they have such a hard time with integrating back into this world of dualism, part of it says, you know, if I were to go out and strike Dave, sorry, Dave, but, you know, if I'm going to go punch him out, literally what I'm doing is punching myself. Literally what I'm doing is, because we are both part of the unity universe. That's the end of part two of what near-death experiencers tell us. We are now ready to start with part three, physics. Who can explain the joke? It took me like 10 minutes to look at this thing and go, what's so funny about it? Please look at the defendant in green. You know, he's like a foot off the ground. like to start this off by reading you a poem by Christopher. Come to the edge.
We might fall.
Come to the edge.
It's too high.
Come to the edge. And they came. And she pushed. And they flew. I put this in here because we're now embarking on the part of this presentation that's going to talk about physics. And it's going to get a little weird. So I want you to hang with me. Be patient. I'm going to try to lead you through this. I'm going to describe a universe to you that I didn't learn about when I went to high school and college. What's interesting for me is that the universe that we're going to be talking about was imagined over 100 years ago. Theoretically, they brought this forth in 1900. It's now 2008, and we're starting to be able to explain it. We have the technology now, thank you very much, to be able to confirm or deny the kinds of things that were explained way back when. Incredibly short history. Physics goes like this. Five major epochs, starting with Newton, and then the field theory guys, the quantum guys, the relativity guys, the string theory guys and girls, because they finally get to kick in here. And then sometime in the future, we're going to be able to tie everything, the classical and the quantum physics people together. We haven't been able to do that yet. I want to explain each one of them just briefly. But first I have to tell you that everybody who has anything to do with physics has bad hair. Now, this projector is really yellow. That's Maxwell Clark up on the left. His beard is like this gnarly knot of curly hair. Faraday in the center, what's with that knob on the, you know, on the left-hand side of his head? Why is it just sticking out there? Why would you pay a photographer to capture that? Next to him, I haven't seen a mustache like that since Urban Cowboy, you know? But of course, Einstein never knew a comb. This guy down here, with that taciturn look, that's Max Planck. I think he's jealous because he doesn't have hair that could look bad. Newton, 1867. He's the guy that came out with four mathematical laws about motion. He saw the universe as being a mechanical system where the parts were independent, they were observable. Clockwork is the word that he used to try to describe this in his book, Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. What he did stood for almost 200 years without change. That people really viewed the universe as being little bits that you could look at and measure, and they just fit together and operated nicely. Even to this day, he's very good at describing large-scale events. Large-scale meaning above the size of an atom to the birth of a star, almost. That black hole thing gets a little weird. Next. Flash forward 200 years exactly, and we've got James Clerk Maxwell with the strange beard and Michael Faraday. And what their contribution was, yo-ho, Newton, guess what? There's some things that really don't work very well. There are fields out there that affect matter that don't seem to be anything, and we want to describe them, magnetism and electricity being those, electromagnetism being those. Then in 1905, our friend Albert Einstein came along and said, remember that thing we talked about time? Because under Newtonian physics, time was, you could measure. I mean, it was just absolute. And he said, no. Depends on where you're sitting. If you're on the fast train going this way, and you're trying to measure something on the train going the other way, time isn't the same. It depends on where you sit, whether time is bigger or shorter. And everybody went, really? And E equals mc squared was born. It helped refine the concepts of Newton's laws such that we can now really accurately describe large-scale events, you know, from the movement of planets to an apple falling off the tree and hitting Newton on the head. We can predict the orbit of satellites. We can deconstruct the radiation from the sun. There's all kinds of things we can do with Newton and the modifications that Albert Einstein gave us. Then comes Max Planck. He went and said, I don't think so. He says, those things that you see, those atoms and neutrons and protons, he says, I don't think that they are what you think they are. They said that this model that you see here with the nucleus and the electrons roaming around it, that was considered to be the most elemental particles of nature, electrons, neutrons, protons. And he's going, that doesn't work. According to my calculations, it can't work that way. What it really is, what matter really is just little packets of energy, and that this energy moves so fast that there are, you can't really pin any piece of matter down. It really just exists as a tendency or a probability. And as such, what we thought was real and solid really isn't. The example I like is movies, right? We've got a film, and each frame is a picture. And with each picture, there's some piece of movement that's a little bit different. But you run the picture by really fast, and you see the movement. And he says, it's kind of like that. We've got these little packets of energy that are exchanging bits between each other so fast that what looks to be real and solid isn't. It's just little packages of energy, which he called quanta. So now we've got a problem. The problem is we have classical physics, the size of the atom on up, that do a fabulous job of describing the physical universe. It works really, really well. We can do all kinds of things. Below the size of the atom, we have quantum physics, which turns out to also describe the level of atoms and below into the subatomic level. It does that very, very well. It describes what happens there beautifully. But the two of these don't seem to merge at all. Kind of like what happens with near-death experiencers. We have a universe of duality, and this unity universe that seems to be separated.
My physics teacher in college said that he had no problem at all with being able to walk through a wall if you had, you know, the ability to, the energy to move, because everything is like magnetized or, you know, like you say, moving, constant motion. And so he said that's all you needed to do, is be able to go through.
And walk right through it. Yeah. Change your state of being.
Yeah, not to bring religion into it, but that would explain how Christ could walk on water. It wasn't made as a process for me.
She's talking about not only Jesus, but other religious masters that have the ability to change matter, walk on water, change water into wine. I mean, there's a number of physical things that could be explained with the malleability of the universe. Okay, 1970, there was a whole group of physicists that said, Max Planck, thank you for those quantum observations. We're really uncomfortable with this whole probability thing. The idea that matter is here, or maybe it's here, maybe it's not, it's a tendency. They said, we're going to bag that, and we're going to come up with this other thing called string theory. The very smallest thing that exists in the universe are these little vibrating strings that exist in, count them, 10 dimensions, although some mathematicians say it's 11. That is how everything is hooked together. Everything is hooked together in the universe because of string theory. This is the very, very, very smallest thing in the universe. Okay, what lays in the future for us is somebody who can take the four major forces of physics, electromagnetic, weak, strong, and gravity, put them all into a package, wrap them up in a nice bow, and give us the unified theory of physics. So how do we actually investigate this kind of, how do we know what the true nature of matter is? Well, what physicists do is they take matter and they make it really uncomfortable. We kick it and we make it do something it's not normally going to do so we can look at its underlying nature. We can hit it with a magnetic field. That's one of the ways you can do this. And they do that at the super colliders. You know, they take an electron and they put it within a magnetic field and they speed it up and speed it up and speed it up. And then they run another one the other direction. And then they put the two together and pow! They run into each other, the thing blows up, and then you can look at all the little subatomic particles. So you can hit things with a magnetic field and make it do weird stuff, so you can see maybe how things work. Or the other thing is that you can take things matter and bring it to absolute zero. At absolute zero, 459 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, there's no energy left in the universe, or in that particular area. None. That's the spot where energy quits zero. It's the coldest that you can ever get. When all the energy is sucked out of the system, you're at 459 degrees Fahrenheit. So you can do that too. Slow things way down in order to take a look at them.
Is the maximum heat?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay, I want to talk about a case that came up in 2001, but before I do, I want to talk about entropy, which is Newton's second law of motion. It says that energy will exist in the highest potential state and it only has one way to go, which is down. So if we were to take that little example here, cut the cord, that square would slide down the ramp and come to rest. Higher energy to lower energy. The ball would be in the air and then it would drop and come at rest. So it moves from high potential energy to low. That's the only direction it moves. Order to disorder. It takes energy to keep things aligned. And if we remove the energy, the natural tendency of physical matter is to do whatever it feels like it wants to. Okay, so knowing that, there's a 26-year-old student in 2001 had a thing published in Science Magazine that said she did a really interesting experiment with a salt called lithium, holmium, yttrium, tetrafluoride, which has, the reason she chose that salt was because it had a natural tendency towards disorder. Very hard to get it to align itself. And the piece she used was about half the size of your smallest fingernail. So you could hold it in your hand and you could see it and they could attach wires to it and you could measure it. So she applied a magnetic field to it, and at one point, when 260 of the atoms aligned, no matter how much she more or less magnetic energy that she applied to it, things moved in concert. So she said, this is really weird. It should be in alignment and then break up, either with more or less energy. But that isn't what happened. Got the 260 atoms lined up and they just stayed in concert. So she said to herself, let's kick it in the butt. So she added heat and magnetic field. Guess what? Same thing happened. 260 atoms lined up, and no matter what she did, that group grew and grew and it started acting in concert like it was one big molecule. It became entangled. Next concept.